Vancouver Island, a land full of rich, diverse cultures where you will find hippies and rednecks at the same local brew pub, blue-collar and white-collar camping side-by-side at the lakes, and old and young and everyone in between with one thing in common, we love our island. There seems to be a running theme with a lot of outdoors people that we have on the show that it wasn't something that they were necessarily born into. This was something that they chose. Today we have one such individual, Matthias Morrison, the senior park ranger for Strathcona Park, where he shares about his journey becoming a wilderness guru and somebody who is very passionate about the wilderness of Vancouver Island. So I've found that I am very notorious is probably not even the most proper way to say it. I am notorious. That's how I'm going to put it. I am notorious for starting all of my shows. I've been listening back and I've been critiquing myself. And I've decided that I do just about the exact same thing every single time. So I'm going to change it up and I'm going to tell a little bit of a story. So on episode 1 or 2, I'm not sure which one it was, Derek Bird was on the show and he was sharing this story. And he paints this beautiful picture of this beautiful mountain area that we will not name because it was mysterious. And
that sounds
and
like
I've had letters written from how people were so mad about how he didn't tell us where it was. But anyway, he had this individual with him and he was bragging about how he's going to get mad at me now for saying bragging. He was not embellishing. He was telling us that this person was going to make their first cast and catch a fish on that first cast.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, oh my gosh, like this is the coolest thing ever. Like, is it really going to happen? And then it happens. And now we get to find out the person that was the person holding that rod.
Oh, man.
And we get to hear maybe the perspective. Today we have Matthias Morrison, friend, a longtime friend of mine, but recently reconnected, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the show, sir. It's wonderful to have you.
Thanks, Benj.
We could go so many different places, but I want to go to that moment with Derek while you were at this beautiful location. What did it feel like casting and catching a fish for the first time?
Yeah, so I recently heard the episode where Derek was describing and given that play-by-play. And I had to laugh out loud when he said something like, and then he made the cast, but he only casted about 10 feet and he needed to cast 20 feet.
He
is 100% correct. We basically just walked up to the shore of this lake and he's like, yep, there's the fish. I couldn't see the fish. And anyway, he saw them and I thought, okay, maybe that dark shape down there is, but I was like, whatever, Derek, like, I'll just follow your plan. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm like completely in your hands.
I've never fished with him, but I feel like I could identify with that.
Right?
That you're just going to get thrown in. Anyway, keep going.
Oh, yeah. No, he had like put the rods together and yeah, so generous. So I basically splat a bunch of line just a few feet from where I'm standing and the fly goes ahead and sinks and he's like, you're on to the fish. And I think I felt it, but yeah. I wasn't really sure. And I didn't really know what I was supposed to do next. So I started reeling, but then, you know, all that free line got tangled. It was a total mess. Derek was more excited than I was at this moment anyway.
He's just thinking about this story he's going to write one day.
Yeah, totally. But he did prime me. He's like, you are totally going to catch a fish on your first fly rod cast. Anyway, so fish on. And then he saw that I was tangled up and I was like, what do I do? And he's like, just start backing up. So I'm like, okay. So I start backing up with the fish on and he landed it. That was basically 100% Derek, and I just was waving a stick and happened to catch the fish.
And see, that's going to be also about the end when it comes to your portfolio, Matthias, of the last time that we're going to hear, I was really terrible at this thing. You have so much experience, and you have so, it's just funny that that's the story that you hear, like, I love it, because you assumed the role of a student. And when you look at your portfolio, you look at all the things that you've accomplished in your life, that's something that you value, clearly. Because, I mean, also being an educator, all of that. I'm not going to talk about every little bit about who you are, though. I would love you to share a little bit about your role and kind of the Vancouver Island wilderness component. We're going to get there. It's going to be fun. But I kind of want to hear just your story of your journey towards the wilderness, because it's kind of one of those, not classic stories, but it's becoming more and more common where I'm hearing this wasn't what I grew up with,
no.
but it's something that became a passion. So yeah, if you could speak a little bit to that.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Vancouver in the False Creek area near Granville Island. So close to...
right downtown, pretty much, eh?
Yeah, yeah, just on the other side of the water, on the other side from the Expo grounds there, Expo 86. So I grew up playing sports, hanging out, playing outside, being kind of a free ranger with my bike, and didn't really get any sort of camping experiences. I knew that I had camping roots or genes with my grandparents. So they were in Washington State, got to visit them, hang out outside, but never really getting out on, you know, a backpacking trip or long hikes. Then grade 11 or 12, definitely was interested, but still had never really done any sort of trip. Took some Christmas money, went to Mount Oakham Co-op, right in my neighborhood there, picked up a backpack, a stove, some other things, and just decided I was going to start backpacking. I think I knew that I wanted to spend some time outside in a forest, but it was just kind of a loose idea and definitely like a self-initiated, self-propelled type trip.
Was it just the lack of it, you think, being like living in a city? Like, what did you find was kind of the catalyst for that?
I think I'd always been a kid who appreciated like being outside. So again, mostly through sports. But my dad took me canoeing, like right on False Creek. We used to, like when I was really young, he used to paddle me to the McDonald's, which is on like Main Street.
Yeah, now, I hear that sentence very often.
No, paddle exactly.
To the McDonald's.
And we landed and pulled the canoe up the muddy bank and had a Big Mac 40 meters away. I remember falling asleep in the bow of the canoe and really enjoying that time, enjoying my time with grandparents, cabin trips, friends' cabins and that sort of thing. So I think I've always felt drawn to be outside, and I have, just a sense of peace being out there, but I did want some sort of adventure. I had heard about like friends and classmates who had done various outdoor education programs, like a grade program. And then, but I was the kid who always heard about it like the year after it happened. Like, oh man,
I missed it.
Yeah. I think I was keen for adventure, right? So yeah, being 17, 18, taking some time in the summer, in the Coquitlam area, me and some friends, we didn't really know what we were doing. I think I studied some navigation, you know, handbook, and got a topo map, Widgeon Slough or Widgeon Lake. It was this kind of like hanging lake up in the subalpine, overlooking the lower mainland, right?
Oh, okay.
3 million people, although a little less then. So we paddled, we decided to get to the lake, but we didn't even know what we didn't know. So like...
It's a blissful state.
Oh man, so many things can go wrong. We didn't have any sort of epic misadventure. Well, we got lost for a couple hours at one point. So that was moderately scary, more because my friends were quite worried about it. I still had the map in hand and I was like, guys, we're not lost. What we later learned, and what I now know, we were traveling at about 400 meters per hour in like really thick bush, thinking we were traveling much further.
Sure.
Totally off trail, adjacent to the trail, but not on it. Anyway, that particular trip, friends packing, you know, 15 pounds of potatoes for a two-nighter, just not, well, we thought we were thinking through. We just, again, we didn't know what we didn't know at that point. But then when I was in Vancouver, still, you know, continued backpacking, got a little bit better at, going on trips and planning a little bit better, decided I wanted to work at Mount Oakham Co-op while I was going to school. So I got a job at the Gap.
Nice. That's a step up, you know?
Oh man, mall work. They were looking at mech. They were looking at people only who had some retail experience.
Sure.
So I used the sweater folding board at the Gap as kind of a stepping stone. But then once I got into working in that retail environment with a lot of like-minded people loving to play outside, I had opportunities to use a lot of gear and go on different kinds of trips, winter trips. And I think that kind of kickstarted the outdoor recreation community that I felt like I wanted to be a part of and then eventually was on the mainland.
Yeah, totally. And it's something that, I mean, that's the role that I know you from. You know, it's cool hearing that part of your story, because when I met you, you were kind of an outdoor guru. Who knows how you're going to say it. But you were somebody that, like, you knew the right places, you knew the right people, you knew the right things to do, and were an authority in that zone. And so how did you go from, you know, kind of outdoor enthusiast to, now I'm going to be an educator, now I'm going to be somebody who's going to teach other people how to do this well in a greater capacity? Like, what was the catalyst for you for that?
Sure. Yeah. Moving to the island. Mm-hmm. So, 2009, I'm a dad of three, but at that time, we had one on the way, kind of imminently due, and one at age two. And we knew we wanted to move to the island. So we came here, and then I left the work that I was doing. I was volunteering, you know, using personal time and volunteer work, I guess, to lead trips informally, and thought, okay, we're moving to the island. This is an opportunity to kind of shift out of the youth work that I was doing. I didn't really know what was next, but knew that I loved backpacking and thought that that would be not necessarily a career path, but just like the next right step for me. Mm.
The next area of where you wanted to work.
Yeah. Yeah. And so at that time I had heard about the Association of Canadian Mountain Guides, and relatively new to their kind of administration and part of their portfolio. It was new at the time. It was the hiking guide program. So I registered for that. It was like a combination course and exam. Okay. So it's about 5 days of coursework and then a 3 or 4 day exam after that point in the Rockies. So I did that program and took wilderness first aid, like an advanced wilderness first aid course. And that really kicked the doors open to start right away as like a sessional outdoor educator for different school programs.
Nice. Right on. And that was primarily like now growing onto Vancouver Island. And so you started going all over the place and building all sorts of teams. Like, you got a whole bunch of things going on.
But. Yeah. You know, a funny thing about that time was I was working for schools that were based in the Lower Mainland, like that's where they were located. They weren't just based there. And they would have, so independent schools, and they would run a lot of programs here on the island. Wanda Fuca Trail, as an example. So I'd go from Campbell River, where I lived, go to Vancouver, pick up my group, come back to the island, and lead a trip, and then go back to the mainland where the students lived and where the school was.
Right.
I was able to meet someone then who ended up employing me for his business. So I was able to guide like commercially
on
the island. So started trips on the West Coast Trail and elsewhere on the island, with like paying guests, non-teenagers, the older, taller, human family types. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I mean, different, right? Though going from, you know, grade 9 or grade 10 student who may or may not want to be on that particular wilderness program that they're on, to guests who are paying, you know, $1,000 or more to go and do a trip.
Yeah. It's amazing the shift I found that, like, when we were working with a lot of these outdoor programs, how you would be working alongside youth, you'd be working alongside, you know, kids, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Kids are really, really totally comfortable with following most of the time. I mean, I'd following? Say that loosely.
Yeah.
Following, right? Like, they're kind of like, you were going to the next thing. You get to teens and they're a little bit more contentious, but doing adult programs, man, that's where the rubber hits the road, because now you've got a whole bunch of people who have it all figured out. And now you're in a wilderness setting where you're a fish out of water in some cases. Yeah. So did you find that was a challenge kind of stepping into that zone?
Yeah, good question. I was just remembering a story recently. I was leading a trip on the Chilkoot Trail, and we're a couple days in, starting on the Alaska side. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Yeah, so
I've
start
seen it on the back of cars. It's like on a Nissan or something, isn't
right.
it? Chilkoot.
Oh yeah, and the Golden Staircase.
Yes,
I think they call it. So it's got this historical significance, and it's like a living, not a living museum. I'm thinking of like the rusty pieces of gold rush kind of stuff that you can see on the side of the trail. Mm-hmm. It's still there. But you go from Skagway, and then it's a couple days of walking valley bottom, slowly gaining altitude, and then ultimately you have this pass to get up and over, and then you end up in the Yukon. But it was the day before the pass, And I had a, well, at the time, I don't think I knew what her profession was. She said, oh, I'm in the legal profession. And just speaking in general terms, but she was really upset that I wanted to wake the whole group up at like 5 a.m. or like some kind of early morning alpine start. She just thought that was totally atrocious, and she's on vacation, and she started to kind of rally some of the other guests and try to persuade them.
That's a nice way of saying mutiny. That's a really kind way of saying mutiny.
Yeah, mutiny, oh man. It didn't quite get there. I caught on to what was going on. And I think she was being honest with me in that she was being direct. Like, that's too early. That's ridiculous. And then it was kind of like, what do you think? Isn't that too early?
Yeah.
And so I explained, hey, you know, like in the mountains, anything can happen. We want daylight on our side. We don't know about visibility. Let's get this thing up and over with fairly soon. Mm. You know, there's lots of good reasons. And hey, you know, I've been doing this a while, you know, I'm sure you're really great in your profession. So I just love you to be able to trust me on this one. And, anyway, it turns out she was, a Supreme Court judge in another province. And so that was kind of her background, but she ended up coming on board with the idea of a really early start and ended up needing most of the help on that particular day as well. So I don't know, I guess that's an example of different communication methods and a little bit of sort of conversational judo to figure out, you know, what's needed here and how am I going to lead, as opposed to, yeah, you know what, buddy, like you're 15 and you're on a school trip and it's just going to be this way.
Yeah. Pride, the real killer. We were talking about that on the last episode we had, not the last one, but one of the episodes with Paul Berry. And we were talking about that too, right? There's all these different instances that happen that can be completely avoidable, but you know, if we can't humble thyself,
yeah,
it causes a lot of problems, or totally. Potentially can. So I'm really glad that you were on that. You know, we might've been having a national crisis of a Supreme Court judge that was missing in the mountains.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting trip, that one.
So then from there, kind of, you did guiding for how many years? How many years did you do it?
About 5 years, I guess.
And then springboarding into there was then kind of, where did you head on after that?
Yeah, so I was working, it was always a combination of like sessional outdoor leadership instruction, worked a little bit with a university program on the mainland, and then guiding kind of a handful of trips per year, mostly seasonal. I was hungry for something else and was approached by a board of directors here on the island that wanted to get something going for youth, kind of like a outdoor leadership training for youth with kind of a camp feel without actually having like a camp property.
Right.
And I got really excited about that. So we developed a program. I guess that was 2013 through 2017.
Yeah.
I was involved in that program, helping some of the residential camps and then putting on guide leadership training programs for young people who kind of wanted an opportunity or a way to perhaps enter the outdoor industry at that pre-university level, at least kind of get them on the right track.
Yeah, definitely. And kind of creating that community even amongst guides, because your crew was always a really diverse group of individuals who had, you know, a whole host of skills, which was really neat to see, because they just had, you know, all these places that they knew really well, and they were able to hit up just about any of these trails and be very, very competent. That was and that's kind of where we met at that time. And so it was really neat to see that all unfold. And then now it's springboarded into kind of to where you are now, essentially. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you kind of did in parks, but starting in Bella Coola.
That's right.
So what brought you onto the parks team?
You know, I didn't really know that I was going to end up wanting to be a park ranger. Mm. That's definitely where I am now, 5 years in, with a little interlude, doing something else in the middle. I guess I didn't really understand how to be a park ranger. I guess what I'm saying is I didn't grow up in Vancouver. Oh, yes, I want to be involved in backpack guiding, which will lead me to this, you know, perfect job as a ranger. I didn't really know how to get hired. I never looked into it. But I think I was watching this show, you may remember, some of your listeners, Prison Break.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, did you ever check that show out? Yeah,
totally.
Okay, so amazing show, the first one or two seasons, and then it just started to get kind of weird. anyway, I'm not a TV critic, but what I remember was, okay, the seasons got weird and there was this prison guard who was in like a foreign country and in a prison, and I had my laptop with me or my phone, and you know, like you do when you're watching TV, or I do these days because I'm ADHD, you know, it sends you off on this curiosity trail. And I thought, oh yeah, prisons, BC, I wonder what that's all about. So I just did like a Google search, BC prisons or BC detention centers or something like that. And it brought me to this government jobs website. And I was like, what? Oh, they're hiring a whole bunch of rangers. That's interesting. And thought about it and talked to my wife about it. Should I apply? Would I enjoy that? You know, I think I had seen one or two rangers in my career.
They're elusive.
They're
right?
Unicorns. Absolutely. And I mean, there's more now than there have been in a long time, which is wonderful. But at that time, I was like, yeah, I'll just throw my hat in. I think I was longing for something not necessarily new, but to be involved in a slightly bigger organization than the small team that I had working here. Or working here on the island, I mean, doing the youth development program. Mm-hmm. So put in for that job in government speak. We call them job competitions. There's some strange government jargon.
That's going to promote some interesting conversations, I'm assuming.
Absolutely. I know we were chatting with some folks in Bella Coola. Hey, you should get into ranger work. Would you consider applying to the job competition? And they're like, oh, yeah. And it turns out they were imagining in their head some sort of like a survivor reward challenge type.
Oh yeah, yeah. Thing. It's like the dark. Have you seen Batman: The Dark Knight?
Yeah.
And then the Joker comes in and he's going to do tryouts to the two gang members. Breaks a pool cue, yeah, runs exactly. In the house, right? He's like exactly. Tryouts. Like that's right. My first idea. That's like, right. BC with, Parks. Here we go.
With a chainsaw and maybe some wildlife and a scenario with an angry camper.
Last one standing wins.
Yeah. Anyway. It's a long way of saying 2017 was offered some positions sort of right across the province, and had a chance to speak with the team in Bella Coola, and I was like, yeah, Bella Coola it is.
Right.
So that's where I ended up. That was, yeah, 2017.
That's awesome. I've never been, but it just sounds beautiful. I mean, you can speak more to that, I'm sure, but what was it like being up in Bella Coola compared to, like, I mean, the island's beautiful. I mean, we're going to be a little bit biased here. It's pretty spectacular, but what was it like going from here to Bella Coola?
Yeah, it's got a beauty that's hard to put into words, or if I were to quantify it, you know, 9.9 out of 10. I mean, I'm biased. I'm partial to the island as well. Full-blown wild islander. Mm-hmm. Bella Coola has a raw, like in a natural sense, it has this raw, rugged beauty, I guess. I mean, that's a catchphrase. But I mean, the example is like the river is always moving, the Bella Coola River or the Anarko River further up valley. And there's parts of Tweedsmuir Park that are just crawling with grizzly bears.
Wow.
All over the place, right? Mostly in the fall. But the grizzly bear population is just off the hook. Mm. Oh, there's a fox. And it's like you're in some sort of wildlife documentary. The rich history of the Newhalk Nation there, and the cultural richness and the stories, you know, from the Newhalk Nation, it's incredible. Mm. And it's remote. And in the springtime, you can hear avalanches pounding down, you know, from the Alpine. It's tight in the sense, like the valley feels tight. Mm. You're hemmed in. It's
dark. You don't have that ocean break that we have a lot of the time right here, where you've kind of got this best of both worlds feel, where you can kind of feel scrunched up to the mountains and you feel safe that way, or if you need that open space. But it sounds like, yeah.
It's a little tighter than here as far as the ocean goes. Like, absolutely, the ocean's there. But the town site and where people live in the Bella Coola Valley is... it's basically at the end of a long inlet. Mm. But so you get this tight temperature gradient, you know, fairly moderate, close to the inlet. And then you go 30 or 40 kilometers up valley and it feels like the interior, like the Chilcotin kind of dry,
like arid. Yeah,
cold,
super dry.
Absolutely cold. And it just dumps with snow in the wintertime. So yeah, I spent, well, I guess just about 3 years working with Parks up there, and we lived for about a year of that time up there as a family. Yeah,
that's awesome. Was there a lot of grizzly encounters? Like, I wanted to circle back to that a little bit, but was there a lot of grizzly encounters in the area, having the population so, you know, they were doing so well, they're so prolific. So was it a kind of a, what was human conflict like with them?
Yeah, in a general sense, every summer and fall, there is what we would call human-wildlife conflict with grizzly bears. There's difficulties with attractant management. So in other words, like apples on trees, right? And grizzlies, they're really smart. Bears are incredibly smart. They'll return to the same tree. You know, I don't know if this is backed by research, but you'll hear bear biologists say, you know, within a year or two, or sorry, within a day or two, the next year, they'll come to the same area as if they got some sort of a food reward.
Wow.
That they...
Just that instinct just brings them right back that this was a happy place.
Yeah.
This, you know, this helped me and I'm going to come back to it.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
But up in the park, so Tweedsmuir Park, there's a bear viewing program. It's operated by BC Parks staff and volunteers, and it's formalized. And then there's lots of informal bear viewing as well. So a lot of tourists from out of town or like not necessarily from BC will come and bring their super high-end camera gear, like lenses that are like 2 feet long. And, you know, what I experienced as a ranger there anyway was a lot of times people would just forget like, oh yeah, I'm actually standing on the shoulder of a highway while I'm shooting this bear with my camera that's, you know, 40 meters away. And it's like this funny mediated experience. Yeah. I think people, I mean, we've all probably been there, right? Like taking a photo with our phone, you kind of forget that the moment is actually happening, actually in real life, right in front of you. So I had to use my big sort of ranger voice at times, like, you know, off the highway, move along. So you're kind of moving people around. Bears in day use areas. Most of them are, they're habituated to humans. So they know that they're there. You know, in many cases, the sows would actually use the people who are, say, having lunch in a day use area or just watching them as cover for other bears that might want to bully them.
Sure.
So they'll want to come close.
Because that's a big part of grizzly bear culture, right? There's a, like, I find that we don't have a very accurate description, I don't think, out here with black bears because they're so, I mean, in my experience from hearing, I don't have any real experience much with grizzlies, but lots with black bear and how they kind of just take off and you don't see a whole lot of that interaction. But you always hear these stories of grizzlies where are pushing off and even, you know, like attacks to the death type of thing.
That's right.
And so did you have any like encounters yourself with any of the grizzly population?
Yeah, I had some close encounters and it was usually with lots of other park visitors around where I was trying to manage them or end up kind of putting myself in front of, you know, tourists who are wanting to take photos.
Live the dream.
Yeah.
Put yourself between you and grizzlies.
Yeah. I had the safety off my bear spray several times and from me to you. Couple times as well.
No.
With
the grizzly.
Yeah, like as it's cruising by.
I'm a weak island boy. Black bears, they just run away from me. But grizzlies, oh, no, no.
I mean, those situations, we weren't having kind of a face-off like we are here as we're having this conversation. It's cruising through.
Right.
But, you know, looking at their claws and making the clickety-clack on the road surface or whatever. Close enough to smell them for sure. But that's a part of the work in that particular park with that population.
And you hear that a lot too, like up in Alaska, I follow a lot of guides and people that have worked there and have done their entire, you know, existence in guiding up in that zone. And most of the time, that's kind of the same kind of story you hear too, right? They just kind of learn to live. And this one guy told a story I was listening. It was like a Close Encounters book, but he was talking about grizzlies in particular and how he got an injury on his leg. I think he broke his leg during the season, and these grizzlies and him had interacted year after year, day in, day out, like almost till they're buddies is what he kind of felt like, right? He had a broken leg and they completely changed how they treated him because he was weak and they could tell. And he said, my interactions with them, like they started getting aggressive. They started coming closer. They started doing things that they'd never done before, but everything kind of changed. And it's just like, man, they're so brilliant, right? Like they're so perceptive. Yeah. They're so aware of what's happening in this, you know, bear eat bear world that they live in. And to be in a park where that's there, that's just so outside of the, I love that kind of thing because it's so outside of what we experience here.
Totally.
Right? Because black bears most of the time just kind of tear off. I mean, we have like in Canada, like what, one bear encounter every 10 years when it comes to like a death or something, mm-hmm. not an encounter, but black bears for the most part, pretty docile comparatively, right?
Yeah.
Big shift for that. So then coming back from Bella Coola, then now moving back here to the island, which is fantastic, which is why you're here today.
Yeah.
And then that brought you to Strathcona Park.
That's right. Yeah. Which
is beautiful. Fantastic.
Yeah. So the island is definitely home for us. We're definitely, as a family, we're pretty firmly planted here. And when I came back from Bella Coola, I had the chance to teach high school for about a year and a half, right, during COVID. I got to meet students for, I guess it was about a week or so just before the March break. Mm. And then everything went online.
They knew you were flesh and bone and that was it.
That's right. Yeah. So I taught outdoor education and PE and then rejoined BC Parks last summer in a short wildfire risk recovery role. And then in December was appointed to be the senior ranger for Strathcona.
Right on.
Yeah.
So what all is encompassed in that role? It sounds fantastic and it sounds like it has a lot of responsibility, and a lot of maybe headaches, but what is that? Paint a picture. What does it look like to be the senior park ranger sure. in Strathcona Park?
Yeah. So there's a quote that I think works well for like, what does a ranger do exactly? Or BC Parks staff, kind of frontline staff like rangers. I think I can attribute it to, Andrea Langford. She wrote a book called Ranger Confidential, her experiences in the National Park Service in the U.S. So she said that rangers protect the park from the people and they protect the people from the park in many cases.
Yeah.
And then less frequently, but it happens as well, they protect the people from the people inside the park.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that is a way to kind of encapsulate that, you know, these are public places. They're protected, you know, probably for really good reasons. I don't know. Yeah, we can get into that a little bit later if you want.
Absolutely.
Why a park would come to be.
Mm-hmm.
But they belong to all of us. Mm-hmm. And we want everyone in BC to be able to belong. And that comes with some responsibilities, too, as far as managing those spaces for safety, right? Because there's a lot of ways to be killed in some of these natural spaces, especially when you get really far off the beaten path, right? Just as far as risks and hazards. And we need to have, you know, if it's not a fence, maybe a sign saying, you know, cliff ahead or something like that. Signs are a big part of what rangers do. That communication piece with the public when we're out there. So that would be an example of rangers protecting people from the park. And then vice versa, you know, the BC Parks mandate, it's a dual mandate. It's one way to look at it. And that's conservation. So we want to conserve some of these values that exist in the park, natural values, other types of values. And then recreation. Right. So conservation and recreation, sometimes they can actually be in conflict with one another.
Absolutely. They can. Yeah.
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 So that would be an example of, let's see, which one am I on now? Are we protecting people from the park?
The second
protecting
one.
The park from the people. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, using Strathcona as an example, there's pretty good reasons why there's no fires allowed except in your designated campsite, you know, much to the chagrin of backpackers who are, you know, way off trail in the park. But again, there are good reasons to protect the park from what people want to do, which is have a campfire.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's so many conversations that we've had over the years with those people, especially I feel like those that are really used to, you know, camping at somewhere, you know, whether it's China Beach, whether it's, you know, in Tofino, whether it's here at Miracle Beach. There's so many people that are like, well, why can't we, right? It's like, well, if we all did, there wouldn't be any, you know, ground wood at all. Yeah. There wouldn't be any of this habitat that you really enjoy, right? And it's that education piece that as gatekeepers, you know, inside of the parks, you have to, somebody has to do it, and it's so incredibly important.
Yeah.
And what a place to do it in, like, Canada, or sorry, BC's oldest park. I mean, the first one, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Park number 001.
Yeah. So incredible history, you know, yeah. And to be a part of that and to help being a steward of that, I think is amazing. But yeah, carry on. Sorry. You
had your sure. Yeah. Thing. And I guess the last piece, yeah, I don't know if it's helpful to kind of unpack that one quote systematically, because it's not comprehensive, but protecting people from people. So we work in, like, we're designated as enforcement officers under legislation in BC. And so we have powers and authorities within provincial parks that can help protect people from people. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a quick example would be different types of user groups. Say you've got anglers who want to fish, and then there's people who want to enjoy maybe that stretch of water for a wildlife viewing. Mm. Those two things, you know, they're not necessarily compatible at the same time. Mm-hmm. And rangers will find themselves in situations where they're having to, you know, it's not like we're breaking up fights all the time, but we're having to manage that on the ground or in the field in real time. So that's part of what we get to do as well.
So what are some of the stuff we're flying through time here? You're not even going to believe where we're at in our interview already. We're cruising, which is great.
Okay.
Which is covering good ground. But what kind of, as people, I love to bring it back to listeners, myself, other people. What's kind of the things that you would pass on as somebody who's being one of those gatekeepers? I mean, you've spoken to it already a little bit, but what are kind of the key things in being a good partaker of the park, like somebody who's going to be there and help steward what's there? What are kind of the tools and being able to do that well from like your experience?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, I guess I'd want to push back a little bit on the word gatekeeper.
That's fair.
So as park rangers, yeah, we have powers and authorities to, you know, write violation tickets and evict people from parks. So in that way, I don't know, steward property, steward. I don't know what a better way to phrase it is, but
I think that's a good picture though.
Sure.
Yeah,
so like,
I think it is. I think it works.
Take for example, someone who, there's a situation in a park where, there's some kind of a resource or value that's being impacted really negatively. And that's maybe ranger speak for, I don't know, what would an example be? Like something outrageous happening in a park.
Something's burning. Somebody did something.
Somebody
made a big mess.
Someone made a mess and lit it on fire, and it's burning.
Garbage fire. That's right. Circlet Lake.
And so, you know, the folks in Victoria would be like, oh no, you know, our capital asset. And but then there's also a big mess and you're going to disturb other park visitors. Mm-hmm. And that's like a big no-no. And pretty sure there's signs saying don't make a big mess and burn it. Actually, you know, not a specific sign that says that, but we know that is wrong.
Yep.
Now, things like that happen, dumping in parks. And there's going to be a role for a park ranger to step in and not necessarily resolve that situation, but apply some sort of action that, like a violation ticket or a notice to appear, right? Mm-hmm. There's like legal processes that we can use. So in that way, we have those powers and authorities. But as rangers, we also want parks to be a place for everyone. I think I said it before, right? A place for everyone to belong. Mm-hmm. We want them to be accessible. And we're seeing a big push towards accessibility when it comes to everything, from interpretive signs to the types of trails that are being put in, so that all types of people, not just an able-bodied, bald white guy in his 40s like me who likes to backpack, right? There's kind of a lot of us there. We want parks to be representative, or places that are welcoming to the representative population of BC.
Yeah.
And in my context, my little slice, Strathcona and Vancouver Island, right? So
it's kind of viewed as a partnership in my mind, right? Because what your role and the other rangers' role and those that are kind of being those stewards, I really do like that term. I think that helps kind of picture that. I mean, everybody's going to have a different picture for that one. But for me, that one really works really well because it helps me paint a picture of what it is that you're trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. And then on our side, how are we being those partners that are using it, those other eyes on the ground? And we've talked about that in other episodes too, how it's really neat, like, you have the one hand where you have so many people using places like the park, mm-hmm. but then you have all of these eyes and ears and people that are so passionate about it that help be the people that they need to be able to those partners to be able to help make sure that it is preserved, that it is taken care of, and that feedback is there. And I think that that's a pretty crucial part, at least from what I see. But mm-hmm. And I think that Parks does a really good job of that, especially in all the signage and everything that's there. I find that so many of the questions that I have about an area, so many questions that I have about what am I to do, what am I not to do, Parks does a really good job. Like, I can't really get away with anything.
Right. Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, I think there's a place for... signage and that education piece. You know, we were talking earlier about signs. I can't remember if it was before we started recording or not, but you know, nothing that our BC Parks team does, as for like taking a sign, for example, it doesn't just happen in a haphazard way or I don't know, let's just put this one up. There's a very thoughtful and slow kind of management planning process that happens before any of that public-facing communication. I mean, sometimes we're in a hurry and we have to put something up quick for public safety or whatever, but usually there's a whole bunch of folks who really know what they're talking about that are a part of those decisions that happen inside the park.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. So what's kind of the takeaway for anybody that you're recommending to come and join the incredible places that Strathcona has to offer this summer? What are some of the things that you would give, you know, as tidbits, is that we all kind of not even know before you go, but what's the senior park ranger want to say to the people
for Strathcona specifically?
Sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd like to be able to hear from the people through BC Parks. Like we've got this great website. There's the, yeah, we call it, it's, well, the email address is parkinfo@bcparks.ca. So if there's a question about a specific area of the park, you know, ultimately that'll probably land on my desk. Mm-hmm. But also if there's information, tips, you know, trail conditions from people who know the area, or if not, that's information that helps us manage better and prioritize areas that need them. Current conditions, questions about the park, totally happy to hear.
Right on.
The website, yeah, I guess I'll want to steer people there. There is lots of great information there. There's also the wider community of users that exist outside of, you know, the BC Parks website. That can be a good information place as well. I mean, Strathcona, there's no one particular area that I'd want to, you know, highlight. Mm-hmm. It's such a big park, mm-hmm. as you know, and it's got everything from marine on the west part of the park all the way up until the Alpine, big tracts of areas that's zoned wilderness. It's really easy to do a remote trip, right? If you're talking recreation, marmot habitat, there are so many cool things happening inside the park. I don't know if there's any one thing that I would want listeners to know, but the website is a good place to at least make a start.
Yeah.
And then again, for people who really want to nerd out on the park, the management planning piece, or the management plan, it's available. Mm. Go and take a look at it. It's a little bit older now, but
a great piece of transparency too, just to see what's happening, what's going on. If those have questions, you know, you can really get a good articulated idea of what's actually happening there.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. And they have great great channels throughout social media as well. They do a good job through Your BC Parks, I think is the handle that they have for most of their things on there. But no, this is awesome. I really appreciate it, Matthias. And I can already feel that we're going to have you back. Go ahead.
Yeah, so just one more thing when it comes to, I guess, planning and preparation. I heard your episode with Paul Berry and he mentioned Adventure Smart. Mm-hmm. So before I joined the Strathcona team that was in place last season, they worked together with Adventure Smart to put a video together specifically for Mount Albert Edward.
Awesome. And I guess, just came out, right?
Is it out now?
I think I just saw it today.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is good news. So there's like a planning and preparation piece for these ambitious type goals, you know, something like Albert Edward. I think it would be great if park users, instead of just jumping in and kind of following their phone and this GPS track, to at least take a look at that video. Mm-hmm. you know, you could Google it. I know we'll link to it from the Strathcona page eventually. There's volunteer opportunities as well. If you just want to spend some more time in parks, there's a Croteau Lake group campsite.
Oh, it's so pretty.
Yeah. Have you been there? Beautiful.
Yeah. We first time last year on our way back, we hiked through there and I didn't even know it existed. Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. So it's one of the newer sites. It's got an interesting history too. There's a book that just came out by Christine Gilbert called A Journey Back to Nature. So it's the history of Strathcona Park, like the last 100 and some odd years now. But yeah, she talks about that area specifically. But where I wanted to go was there are volunteer opportunities for people who want to be a backcountry host.
Oh, cool.
For a week at a time.
Right on.
We're taking applications for that. If you don't get it this year, it'll be available next year as well.
Awesome. Right on. And that can be all connected through the BC Parks website?
Yeah. If you go to bcparks.ca on the front page there, there's a volunteer button.
Okay.
You click on that. It's right at the top of that page.
Right on. That's awesome. Well, okay. When we do the launch for this, we'll definitely have that information in there too. Cannot thank you enough, Matthias. It's been so fun to catch up and hear a bit of your story. This is awesome.
Happy to be here.
Just be able to, you know, paint a bit of the picture that people in these positions that are helping be, again, we're going to use that word steward, I think it's really important to understand the person. And this is a great opportunity for people to know the passion that you have for not just the outdoors, but specifically for the island and now Strathcona. So thank you so much for taking the time to share your story.
Oh, thanks, Benjamin. I really appreciate what you're doing with this podcast, helping tell the stories of Vancouver Island. And like, this is the place that you and I both live. Mm-hmm. And I think to understand it better, we need to hear some of these stories, and you're a part of doing that. So yeah, much appreciated.
Thanks. Really appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening this week in the Wild Islander with Mr. Matthias Morrison, Senior Park Ranger for Strathcona Park. If you'd like to follow along with Matthias's journey, you can follow him at @ranger_mash, where he will start posting all of the things that he can about the incredible Strathcona Park area. You can also follow @yourbcparks for information on all things BC Parks, and you can go and check out the website bcparks.ca for all the information that Matthias talked about. Maybe you want to volunteer. Maybe you want to go and do that Croteau Lake amazing opportunity that he was talking about for volunteering. Go and check it out and go and follow along for their journey. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.